Welcome to the Safety Podcast with your host, all the way from a small green island in the wild Atlantic Ocean, Richard Collins.
Hello and welcome to the Safety Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Collins. If you're a regular listener, thanks for tuning in with us again here. If you're a newbie, and hopefully we've got a few newbies on this one, you're really welcome to the show, and hopefully you enjoy our content. We have quite a bit of content now you can go back and listen to and catch up with as we move forward into 2019. I'm delighted to have Professor Tim Marsh on the show today. If you don't know Tim, well, where have you been? Tim is a prolific psychologist, behavioral safety expert, and well-being specialist. He has a complete litany of accolades. He's a distinguished author of several books. You may have seen him as a keynote speaker at some of the highest profile safety events across the globe. And he has worked with many world-leading organizations as an advisor, including the World Health Organization and the European Space Agency. Tim's very latest publication is called Organized Wellbeing: Proven and Practical Lessons from Safety Excellence. The aim of the book is to help us fill the performance gap when it comes to well-being by recognizing that both organizational and personal well-being are very much interconnected, and also that we need to embrace the truth that good work is good for you. I think this conversation ties in really well with our previous conversations with Andrea Baker. If you haven't listened to those already, I would encourage you to go back and listen to those podcasts as well, because a lot of the themes tie in well together and we hear some of Tim's views on similar subjects. So let's shoot over and speak to Professor Tim Marsh. Thank you very much for coming on to the Safety Podcast. You're very welcome on the show, apart from the fact that you're an avid Wales rugby supporter, but we're not going to mention that today, okay?
Well, apparently your lads are coming over to play a game. They were scheduled to come over a couple of weeks ago, but they didn't show up.
Enough said. We'll move on swiftly from that. How are things with you, Tim?
They're fine, thank you. Especially since we've just put the Grand Slam to bed and looking forward to the World Cup.
Well, we'll not get into that too much because I know we could talk for a while on the rugby. And maybe we'll tie in after the World Cup and see how everything went, but it should be interesting. So, yeah, as I say, thanks very much for coming on to the show today. You're pretty well known around the safety circles as someone who knows their stuff and gives some really interesting insights into psychology and how people behave in the workplace and so on. Just for those who maybe aren't so familiar with yourself, can you give us a little bit of your background and sort of what it is that you do?
Sure. My PhD was looking at reasons for suicidal behaviour in the army. But soon after that, I took over from Dominic Cooper with a behavioural safety research project through UMIST, funded by the HSE. Back 25 years ago or so now, went from behavioural safety as a researcher. The phone rang, of course, people saying, do you do this stuff commercially? Commercial behavioural safety. Once you start looking at the reasons why people behave as they do, you pretty soon end up in safety leadership. And when you look at why leaders do what they do, you end up in safety culture. And when you look at safety culture, you end up in culture, which takes us full circle, really, back to where I started with looking at the culture of the army and how it was provoking some young men into drastic action.
Well, so it sort of came full circle for you, and so generally now you reckon you've come right round to looking at culture from a broader perspective. Is that what you mean by culture?
Yes, well, just a culture of excellence, or, you know, some organizations would call it a culture of care. I think Shell used that expression that there has to be a culture of care, you know, care to get the job done right, care to look after your colleagues, care to excel as an individual, care to look after your colleagues. So, and more when you do, say, for example, when you do a safety leadership exercise and say what makes a good safety leader, 90% of the answers you'll get on your board are nothing to do with safety at all. They're all entirely generic. Competencies and habits around being a good listener, being able to give feedback effectively, staying calm, being thoughtful, etc., etc.
Yeah, I'm sure most people that are listening can agree with that. Although it doesn't take away from the fact that we have the word safety branded across our foreheads, of course.
that's the way it feels. Immediate consequences of being unsafe. We're back to the Health and Safety at Work Act and so on. But increasingly, as you well know, Richard, the world is HSE is looking at health. So a recent client had a challenge for me on human error generally and said, we just cannot make mistakes. They're ridiculously expensive. I won't tell you who they are, but it made the newspapers. And the challenge was, how do we stop people making mistakes? We can't have any accidents. I said, well, I wouldn't worry about somebody falling down the stairs when they're in this building, looking after some very important machinery and computers. I'd worry about them running amok with an axe, because they're 35 times more likely to kill themselves than to be killed in an accident. So if you're worrying about disruption, you need to be worrying about mental health. And huge numbers of clients now are just all over the mental health issue, because of that. There's no financial penalty yet, really. The laws aren't strong enough to push a really good push on it, but they're doing it because they're appreciating it's a win-win.
Obviously, that's good news for anyone who, employee, employer, or otherwise. Do you think with all this attention on it, from what you've seen, A, that it will catch up quickly, and B, that actually businesses are really ready to embrace this properly?
Well, I think they are, and two types of organization. Everybody wants to talk about it. Some organizations are still very much like the old safety culture stuff. They're looking for magic bullets. We can put somebody in a room with an inspirational speaker for a couple of hours, they'll all come out fixed, or we'll put everybody through mental health first aiders and that'll fix it. But other organizations, I think, are genuinely buying into the whole win-win, and are appreciating that actually doing it well is going to make them money, and it's going to make them more sustainable and resilient as organizations. And in these days of uncertainty and financial crisis and so on, that's very attractive to lots of people. But the only people who are pressing go on genuinely ambitious and holistic and integrated programs that are likely to be effective, that's a business decision. It's lots of warm conversations from well-meaning people, but the people who are actually doing it are doing it for business reasons. So it was ever this, though, wasn't it, I guess?
Does that link in to some of your recent work around the holistic model of thriving that you mentioned?
Yeah, well, it does, because, if you look at why people are having a bad day at work, they might bring in things from outside, of course, and so long as we don't actually hurt them. So the first things first, don't actually hurt them. But the things that go wrong when you're at work are that you have a job that you don't enjoy, or you're not very good at, because you've been promoted to something from that you were good at up to something that you're not very good at, and you don't get the training to go with it, the Peter principle. Or it could be that you work in a quite toxic, blame-driven culture, rather than one that's based on learning and empowerment. Or it could simply be that your direct supervisor is a complete idiot who really needs to swallow Carnegie's book on winning friends and influencing people. And so on. So having a good day at work, good work is good for you. If you go into work feeling X and you enjoy your job, you come out again a little bit better. On the other hand, bad work is bad for you. So if you go into work struggling and you have a horrible job, you'll come out even worse. So the whole thing becomes either a vicious or a virtual circle, really.
It would seem to me that this, this challenge, you can correct me if I'm wrong, really would necessitate a lot of, in many businesses, a lot of cross-functional interaction and working together. It's not just obviously the job of a safety professional or one person in an organization. It is a big cultural shift, and a lot of resource would need to be pointed towards it. What do you see as the biggest challenges to overcoming that, if that is a correct assumption? Maybe it's not.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's a very short answer. The better HSC and human resources work together, the closer they work together, the better. End of, as they say up here in Manchester. We've all seen examples where they're not doing that very well, and that's never going to be helpful if you're trying to put together a holistic model of well-being and thriving.
We have actually discussed that same issue with a couple of people before on the podcast, so it's interesting to hear it again and just reiterates the sort of the importance of it. And when we think about the human performance aspect, we were discussing that with Andrea Baker on the show just recently there. What are your thoughts around the human error and the acceptance of human error and people's appetite for taking risk in the workplace? Is there anything that we can do as HSE professionals to create a positive environment for human performance where we can find the right balance between risk and reward?
In terms of error acceptance, I think perhaps if any of your listeners haven't read the book Black Box Thinking by Matthew Saeed yet, where he stresses that error is inevitable and we have to have a learning approach to error, that they really should. I think it's the best book about safety. It's not directly about safety, although he does actually interview Sidney Decker, I think. But it's the best book for a safety professional to read that's been released in 20 years, I honestly think. My own model of safety culture is once you've hit diminishing returns with systems, procedures, training, inductions, and so on, the paperwork and the basics of safety one, some people would call it, it's all really about transformational leadership and empowering leadership and learning and the quality of your learning. I couldn't agree more that minimize blame, maximize learning. Obviously, there's a balance to be struck, you know, and obviously the just culture model really helps with that, that occasionally somebody actually does need to be blamed for something. But you always know when that is because the workforce will tell you, you know, you've got to do something about that. So if you get the workforce involved in the application of a just culture model, that kind of takes care of itself. In terms of the overall error approach, James reason, error is completely inevitable, but it'll cluster. So have a look at the reasons why it clusters and do something about it proactively. You know, and that, I know he's incredibly controversial at the moment, but that guy Jordan Peterson, is it?
Yeah.
The Canadian academic, in his book, he wrote a chapter on risk, which I reviewed. And he says...
Yeah, that's what I was reading. I thought that was really interesting, actually.
But, you know, and he says in that, he says, look, you know, if you've got kids, you give them a playground that's too safe, they'll either ignore it or they'll adapt it. So if there's something that's too safe to climb through, they'll climb over it. And he makes the case really quite convincingly that young men especially, he gets himself into trouble when he starts making differences between genders. But, you know, young people push it. And like pushing it, and it's not so much a risk tolerance, it's a risk appetite. And we've got to accept that. So I think Formula One is a really good example of all of this this stuff. You know, they used to kill about 2 people a year for a long time, and then after the Senna accident, they got together and said, this stops now. You know, we're going to apply some of this fantastic capability that we have, not just to speed, but to safety. Then we're going to share it. And then they had that fireball where they realized that one of the young mechanics hadn't realized how incredibly important a small filter was, you know. So as a really good example of a top-down and bottom-up approach to improving safety culture. And you know, they only killed one person in 20 years, I think, since. And what you got there is really the bow tie effect, haven't you? Nobody has slowed down and everybody is still trying to drive really quickly. But what they've done is they've mitigated the consequences of getting it wrong. So it's really a really good example of how the bow tie is supposed to work, isn't it?
Yes, the recent guest on the show, Andrea Baker, who specializes in human and organizational performance, was emphasizing the fact that it's really human nature to often take the path of least resistance, especially that comes into play whenever priorities change or the goal changes, but even more so when there's goal conflict and we're being asked to prioritize different things, including safety and our own health and so on. Do you have any views on how we can, as HSE professionals and managers of people, just be more proactive to try and address that reality?
Well, yeah, I mean, the two key questions, if you like, the best reactive question when you've seen something wrong is why did you do it? But curiously, not aggressively. And a proactive question is there anything slow, inconvenient or uncomfortable about doing this job safely or healthily? Because often the answer will be yes. And again, there's an opportunity to understand where the temptations are. That's the ABC analysis, of course. You know, where are the temptations? Because if people are tempted, you know, Oscar Wilde said he could resist everything except temptation. Stephen Fry is funnier. He says, you know, what I do with a temptation is I give into it straight away, saves on the faffing about. and we chuckle at that. Aristotle said that humour is merely common sense speeded up. So we chuckle at that because we know that if there is a temptation, it's just a head count of how many people will give in to it and how quickly, the bottom of Heinrich's triangle will fill up with risk and at risk or unsafe behaviours.
Just as you've mentioned that there, it sort of brings me back to the point about you may like the fact or not that I'm bringing this up, but the safety one and safety two aspect, I think I was mentioning to you before, Tim, that I'd seen some conflict in the safety world between people who either think that, you know, traditional safety views are still the only way to look at things, or they're in the next camp, which is the safety differently approach number two. I think you have a slightly different take on it, do you?
Well, I have an opinion on it. I mean, when people come up to you at conferences and ask, are you safety one or safety two? You just want to beat them around the head, really, and say, well, I'm both, you know. But as Hal Nagel himself says in the book, you know, obviously safety one is the foundation, and excellence is huge to a great extent delivered by safety two. As I said it myself, I think, earlier on, you know, once you've hit diminishing returns with your systems, your procedures, the stuff that the safety professionals do, and the designers and the ergonomists and all that, then it's all about transformational leadership and empowering leadership. And learning, we're back to Matthew Said's black box thinking. So we've known that for a while. And the man who wrote the book Safety Differently, of course, he also wrote The Field Guide to Human Error some years ago, where he articulated that really well and influenced huge numbers of people. So I honestly don't think that Safety Differently is particularly different from stuff that's been happening for quite a while. Also based on the same thinking from a lot of the same people, frankly. And in terms of the controversy, I mean, I think one of the things that I have a beef with is the whole safety triangle. I just finished reviewing a book, Workplace Fatalities, by Todd Conklin, and he gives the safety triangle a pretty good kicking all the way through. And I might have missed it, but I didn't see any defense of the principle in there. And I honestly think that the principle of the safety triangle is incredibly important because, for example, on an oil rig, you know, if the likelihood of falling down the stairs 100,000 to one, nobody holds the handrails. And they're used a million times a year, you're going to get 10 bad falls. If it's 90%, one bad fall, 99%, one bad fall every 10 years. There's a direct relationship between the bottom of the triangle and the top. Now, trying to use that data to predict process safety incidents is stupid. But I don't think anybody with a brain would try and do that, frankly. But what you can do is you can apply the same principle for process safety to things like shift handovers, risk assessments, permit signed blind, all that kind of dialogue and thought stuff that the Safety Differently crowd so rightly promote. So I do think the principle of the safety triangle is really strong. I mean, even in well-being, I mean, you know, the Dalai Lama, I saw him interviewed once and they said, how come you're so happy all the time? And he said, well, it might have something to do with the fact that I've been practicing really hard at it for 60 years now. So even in the world of well-being, that you get the look that you deserve by doing the graft on a day-to-day basis applies. And so a very good book by Matthew Said called Bents, which talks about this. He talks about how incredibly hard most successful people have worked to get there. you know, and he gives an example of Mozart. And says, you know, everybody thinks Mozart's the poster boy for a born genius, but it turns out his father was a strict disciplinarian musician, made him practice all day every day from before he could walk, mm-hmm. and most of his early stuff was rubbish. In fact, there's some expert musicians who think he was a bit of a late developer, frankly, given the 10,000 hours that he'd already done by the time he was 10 or something. So I'm a great defender of the principle of the triangle. Obviously, using personal safety data to try and predict process safety incidents is a nonsense.
So Tim, well-being is a big part of what you do nowadays as well, and I can say anecdotally that I can see how this statement rings true. You believe that if people can get well-being right in an organization, that will actually deal with 80% of their behavioral safety issues. I was just interested to know where that comes from and how you justify it.
Obviously that's not researched data. I'll explain that. With a simple story, if you like.
Go ahead, leave us with a nice story there, Tim. That's good.
we'll have a story then.
Okay.
A nice illustrative story. Juan Fangio is driving in the Le Mans race. I think it was 1958. He's coming up to a blind corner, and round the corner in front of him, the worst accident in motor racing history. I think it was 88 people were killed. And he slowed down. It was a blind corner, but he slowed down. And afterwards, they asked him, well, how did you know to slow down? And his explanation was, well, as I was driving along in my bright silver Mercedes, I'm Fangio, I'm twice a world champion, I'm doing 200 miles an hour in my bright silver Mercedes, I noticed nobody was looking at me. So I knew something important had happened around the corner, and so he slowed down. So you know, we could all agree that if we could just get that level of situational awareness, you know, we wouldn't be doing too bad at work. And so extrapolating from that with a made-up figure, of course, I mean, there's no research basis for this. If we could just get everybody bright and alert and as switched on as Fangio, really 80% of, I would argue that at least 80% of all accidents would take care of themselves, because you don't stumble over things and you don't make silly mistakes. You know, so for example, my business partner, Jason, he talks about the fact that he fell off the roof because he was in a really bad state. He didn't like his job. He didn't like being away from home. And even though he was earning three times as much money as a roofer than he was as a sign rider, he was drinking too much and he was unhappy. And on the day in question, he'd had a big night out the night before. He was in a bit of a funk. He says, look, if I'd had a clear mind and a good attitude on the day, I probably wouldn't have done it. But if I hadn't fallen off that day, I'd have probably fallen off the next week. So it's anecdotal that you know, 80% of all accidents would take care of themselves, but I bet it's not far from accurate.
In terms of actionable things that people here listening today can do as health and safety professionals to help get well-being right, can you give them anything that they can do and take away to take action to actually just make a positive impact?
Well, yes. I mean, the basics of a strong culture is learning. Asking people, you know, why are you doing what you're doing? Is there anything slow or uncomfortable? What do you need from us to do this job safely? All those good questions, as Todd Conklin would put it, help generate a culture of empowerment and trust and brothers keeper behavior. I think something like Shell would call it a culture of care. Certainly the transformational leadership does the same thing. So praising rather than criticizing, leading by example in a good way rather than in a bad way, coaching rather than telling, communicating effectively and well, all that stuff. So if you're having a world-class safety culture or a world-class culture, inevitably you're going to make a situation in work that is reasonably positive. And so you then get the benefits of good work is good for you. Because if you go to a workplace where there's blame, where you're criticized all the time, where nobody listens to a word that you say, where nobody asks you anything along the lines of how can I help you get through today and do a good job safely. Mm-hmm. If you don't get any of that, obviously then you've got the downside of a bad job is bad for you. So you get these virtuous or vicious circles applying. And so it turns out that really, in order to have really strong well-being at work, the root causes, the emotional intelligence of frontline supervisors, the vision piece, a strong supportive culture is exactly the same. So you sort of kill two birds with one stone, if you like.
Awesome. That's a really nice action point for people to take away and just have the self-awareness of the next time they're walking past someone, seeing them doing an activity. And I think another thing is, you know, they need to detach themselves from any prior relationship or interaction that they may have had with the people, if it was negative particularly, you know, so that they can, you know, reset their mind, I guess, to ask that positive question rather than if they've got into a situation where they're, as you're just mentioning, being negative.
Well, I mean, isn't that the eternal Buddhist challenge, to be mindful of the moment and leave the past behind? And something we're all struggling with, frankly.
That's it. The human condition. Well, thank you very much for coming on to the Safety Podcast today, Tim. It's been very interesting to speak to you, apart from the rugby, of course.
Okay. Well, I've got a joke for you, actually, talking about the Buddhism thing, since it's come up.
Go ahead.
We went up to the hot dog seller, and the Buddhist who went up to the hot dog seller and said, "Make me one with everything."
Very good.
I heard that this morning. It's good,
on that bombshell. Well, thanks again, Tim, and hopefully we'll keep an eye out on what you're up to. I'm sure over the next few months I'll take some links off you and post it on the show notes for people if they're not familiar with your stuff and some of the literature that you have as well. So thanks again, and look after yourself.
Okay, cheers, Richard. Thank you for inviting me on.
Well, folks, that was Tim Marsh on the Safety Podcast. Hope you enjoyed that conversation. Little bit of banter about the rugby mixed in with some more serious stuff. If you're interested in hearing more about what Tim does, I'll drop some notes, as I say, into the podcast description so you can see Tim's website along with Jason Anker, his business partner, and some other folks there who are doing a great job providing services to industry. And also I'll list some of his books and some of his free media as well, which you can check out. Some of that's really interesting videos and articles and so on. As always, thank you ever so much for joining us here in the Safety Podcast. Don't forget to rate, review and subscribe on whichever platform you're listening to. Your support is really essential to keep this project going, and we hope you got some value from this episode. All being well, we'll see you for the next one. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Safety Podcast. We would love you to tell us which episode you would like to hear. Don't forget to give us a shout at safetypodcast.com.